you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them.
The song is News Goo. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on the PRN. And I'm going to take that again. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, talking about the media and the issues that are not talked about often in the media about the media. My guest this week is somebody I've admired for many, many years. His name is Gareth Porter. He's an investigative journalist. He's an author. He's a policy analyst. He also was born just 7 days before I was in June of 1942. He also went, as I did, to Cornell University. So here we are having a little reunion on this program and talking about his coverage of important issues that often do not get treated well in our media. Gareth, how are you, and welcome to the program.
Hey, I'm fine. Thanks for having me on. It's great to hear your voice again, Danny. It's been a long time.
At any rate, you know, you and I go back to covering the Vietnam War at another time, a war that ended in some ways, but the media coverage patterns of it don't seem to have ended. You worked for Dispatch News Service, based in Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City, as the bureau chief, and you were often challenging the dominant narrative of the coverage of the war. And you seem to be in the challenging the narrative business because there's so much to challenge.
Well, it's very interesting looking back on it that I was indeed, when I was very young, and having my first opportunity to practice journalism when I was the bureau chief in Saigon, to really do a kind of investigative journalism. And I didn't think of it as that at the time, but later on, looking back, I realized that I was beginning to do the kinds of things that I ended up doing ultimately full-time as an investigative journalist, writing particularly since the Iraq invasion of Iraq in 2003 on U.S. wars and threats of war in the Middle East. It seems to me that is indeed the primary theme in my adult life, that I was always looking for the lies that were underlying U.S. policies of use of force in various parts of the world.
I think that's why I took on the MO, if you will, of the news dissector, because in my own way in Boston on the radio and subsequently as a blogger, dissecting news became something that I came to specialize in, and starting and editing MediaChannel.org is a continuation of that work. But let's just go back a little bit about to flesh out your bio a little for our listeners, because the Dispatch News Service no longer exists. But, you know, today we have a healthy independent media, I guess Intercept Media, with Glenn Greenwald and co, who are, you know, kind of exposing the NSA crimes. Comes to mind when I think of Dispatch News Service, because it was Dispatch News Service that carried the exposés of the My Lai massacre at a time when other media did not cover what was one of the most significant and tragic stories of the war.
That's true. Of course, Cy Hirsch was the one who did the exposé, and it was indeed using the Dispatch News Service International as the vehicle for getting it out. And I have to say that story of My Lai is really, in a way, emblematic, as you've suggested in your remarks, of the problems of the corporate news media in covering major, really, you know, fundamental issues that relate to U.S. wars abroad. I've more recently, in the last several years, I have had occasion to go back to the My Lai issue and to look at how the military board that was named by the Pentagon to investigate My Lai was really a massive cover-up of the role of General William Westmoreland. And it was all fixed from the very beginning. But that story never really quite got into the news media. It was always covered as an almost heroic and certainly decent gesture on the part of the military to try to come to terms with the My Lai massacre, when in fact it was only dealing with the responsibility of lower-level officials or officers, I should say, rather than the highest-ranking officials, including Westmoreland himself, the commander of the U.S. troops in Vietnam.
We're going to have time to move on to some of the work you've done more recently about Iran and Syria, but I think we should revisit this because, obviously, the My Lai massacre is not a number one subject in the schools of America, teaching about war crimes. Kind of paint the picture for those who may not remember, may not have been alive when it happened, may not know about it.
Right. I mean, you know, My Lai is so terribly central to understanding not just the Vietnam War itself, but the whole mentality of the U.S. national security state as it dealt with questions of intervention in Southeast Asia and in the world at that stage of its development, that is the 1950s and 60s. And therefore, you know, it is really worth much more attention than it has gotten as a historical issue.
So My Lai is what they called a hamlet. It was a village, in Vietnam. One day, an American unit, which was involved in counterinsurgency, came there. What happened in My Lai to the people there?
Well, to back up one or one and a half steps, the troops who were sent into My Lai had been briefed ahead of time that they were going to go in to a Viet Cong base area and that they were to, in effect, treat the people who they encountered as the enemy. And when questions were asked about civilians, they were brushed off. They were told, well, there won't be any civilians there. And that, of course, was a blatant lie by the higher-ups who were briefing the troops, the individual unit commanders for that operation. And so what they were doing was sending ground troops into a hamlet which was essentially a civilian area with very small contingent of local troops who were simply going to fade away anyway if U.S. troops came in. And just to be very, very clear about this, what was really going on is that this was the most obscene and most extreme example of a much broader phenomenon, which was that General William Westmoreland had let the entire command and staff under his command in Vietnam know that it was the policy, his policy and the policy of the United States, to treat the population in the base area, the long-term base areas that the Viet Cong had, both in central Vietnam along the coast as well as in the areas of the Mekong Delta, that the population was to be treated as the enemy if they were in areas that the United States went in on sweeps, they were not to be concerned with civilian casualties.
So what happened was a massacre, and it was a massacre involving American soldiers shooting down women and children. I remember, it was a big, very famous poster that was made of this, the pictures of all these people lying out on the ground, and the poster simply said Q for question, and babies, yeah. A, and babies.
Yes. Yes, it was the clearest and most extreme massacre that occurred in the Vietnam War, the one that was most, of course, most described, most documented, but it was not the only one. There were certainly other cases that partook of massacres on a smaller scale. And, of course, Nicholas Nick Turse's book on American war crimes has gone into this now in much more depth.
Of course, there was also a famous whistleblower who wasn't really a journalist to start off, Ron Ridenour.
Ron Ridenour, yes.
Who actually brought this information to the attention of the command and had to fight for people to even listen to him, much less investigate this. There was an attempt at a cover-up involving Lieutenant Calley. You know, this is an example, when looked at as a micro kind of example of what was happening there, that tells you the whole story in a way, not just the story of brutality on the ground, but indifference among the military elite who basically saw these people as disposable and in effect disposed of them.
Yes, and indeed, I just want to underline this. In my essay, which unfortunately has still not been published, but it's supposed to come out in a book on U.S. war crimes in Indochina, I document the fact that there was indeed a MACV, that is a Military Assistance Command Vietnam document, which laid out the policy to be followed with regard to the civilian population. And that document, which I found in the not the National Archives, but in the archives of the military, the Army National University, Army's University in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, actually specifies that in the long-term base areas, the population is not. Is to be considered as disposable. It doesn't use that term, but it makes it clear that there are no limits on the use of military force with regard to the civilian population in the long-term base areas. And, well, and that is, of course, My Lai was in Quang Ngai province, a part of one of the longest base areas that the Viet Cong had had, even going back to the days of the Viet Minh War against the French.
I just want to make two points, and then not to delve into this deeper, but just to advise people that in Vietnam, the so-called Viet Cong was referred to as the National Liberation Front. Viet Cong and the National Liberation Front was made up of nationalists, Buddhists, and communists. It wasn't just communists, but it was simplified as Viet Cong to justify the killing of these people as if they were just all commies who were challenging, American efforts to free the country and supporting Russia and China or whoever. So language was very important in that respect. But the other aspect I'd like to draw on is Gareth, your work. You're not just a reporter. You're a historian. You actually go to the library, not just Google it, and look for documents. I was with a team recently at the National Security Archive at George Washington University, mm-hmm. which is filled with now declassified documents that really tell the hidden story of American foreign policy. But you have actually gone and unearthed some of these documents. Why do you do that? Why do you put so much effort in to try to get to the original sources?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that, of course, original source documents are really the only way that one can find the reliable truth about what actually happened. I mean, this is not to say that you can rely only on those documents, but they are of inestimable value. They are just the only way that you can be on sound ground in trying to interpret the history of U.S. foreign policy, national security policy. So it is simply the basic building blocks for having any chance to find the truth. But then there's a second point that is related to that, and that what I've found in my work as an investigative journalist, and I try to combine the two roles of historian and investigative journalist as much as possible, is that when you get an actual document, whether it's a historical document or a current document, when there's something on paper that goes into some detail, there are always telltale signs when the government is lying, when it is not telling you the truth, because you will find inconsistencies, you will find gaps, you will find the dogs that didn't bark that tell you that something's wrong here. And that has been, I have discovered, absolutely essential to being able to carry out the role of investigative journalist. Because
I think this is a methodology, in a sense, going for the original documents, trying to decode them, get through the various jargon that institutions use to camouflage what they're doing.
Yes, it is indeed. It's deciphering jargon. It's deciphering language that is meant to mislead in many cases. I mean, particularly when it's a current document that, you know, that is released to the public. It is meant to mislead, and so it is important to really study it carefully. And by studying it, you do find that there are, as I've just said, telltale signs that give away the game that's being played.
Well, I think this is why, in part, the Snowden revelations, you know, have had the impact that they've had, because they're coming directly from the inside of the national security state, from the NSA itself. But, you know, Snowden himself was very careful, and according to Greenwald's book, and from what we know of him, you know, and basically sending documents to the journalists to offer them background and context so they could make sense of what these documents mean. It's not an easy read for somebody unfamiliar with the systems of classification and obfuscation within the reporting system.
Right, and I would just underline the point that you made about the importance of the fact that Snowden did in fact have these actual documents from within the system. I mean, that is precisely what gave him the credibility. That is why he's the threat, simply by making the accusations themselves, he would not have gotten anywhere. It was the fact that he had these documents and that they could not be denied, that they were authentic, that he was such an important threat.
But it took journalists of conscience, it took journalists of integrity and people who cared to really put the time in and the effort in, Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and their team, to actually bring this information to the public in the same way that it took, you know, Seymour Hersh and you and your colleagues to really work at getting this information out through a media system, and often in the face of a media and despite a media system that didn't want to do that.
Well, yes, and that brings us, of course, to the other side of the picture, which is the uphill battle. I would say even more strongly that there's a kind of iron curtain that surrounds the corporate media in terms of making sure that stories that they don't have to publish, that they don't want to publish, don't get published. And I've run into this many, many times when I felt that there were stories that I had broken that were legitimate, not just legitimate news stories, significant major news stories that were simply ignored by the corporate news media. And since my book, A Manufactured Crisis, about the Iran nuclear scare has been published, I've been particularly concerned with this because I've been making very strong efforts to try to find some way to get the major stories that I have in my book somehow reflected in news coverage, and I've been totally unsuccessful so far.
Well, you know, we're going to try to help you to the degree that we can in talking about this, because it's very relevant and very important. And of course, you're dealing with the Iran situation. I myself, just the other day was sent some footage from Iran when I was there as a filmmaker at a film festival, and I paid a visit to the former American embassy in Tehran, which was, of course, the scene of the hostage drama dramatized in the movie and maybe misdramatized in the movie Argo.
Yes.
And one of the things that was going on there was the fight for documents, the fight for information about what the CIA was doing. The students who invaded it were less concerned with the higher issues of, you know, of policy as much as the fact that they believed that the embassy had become a spy den.
Mm-hmm,
it had become a spy nest. It was filled with all these documents, which they later, to their credit, managed not only to get before the internet even existed, but after the documents themselves had gone through various shredding machines and were burned chemically and were, you know, they managed to reconstruct a lot of them. They've published, I don't know if you know this, Gareth, 77 volumes.
I hadn't realized it was 77 volumes, but I know it was a remarkable
77 volumes of documents.
Yeah.
You know, and that was their main thing. They were saying, listen, this building is not about diplomacy. It's about spying on us.
Yeah.
We're against that, and we want to stop it. And, you know, what's interesting is this angle, though, of the whole hostage crisis and the motivation of the people who went in there has not been reported to this day for the most part.
That's true. And of course, there's this incredibly funny, not funny, but strange irony in the situation because, in fact, all of the spying that the CIA was doing on Iran did no good whatsoever. In fact, the CIA was totally ignorant of the situation there. They had no clue as to what was going on. They got it all wrong.
which is interesting because, you know, recently Alexander the Great, Keith Alexander, who stepped down from the NSA command module. You know, they actually have an office there that they modeled on the Star Trek set.
I do know that now, yes.
Okay. Well, Alexander made a statement saying, you know, despite all of our spying, things are getting worse, okay? The
yeah.
threat is more serious than ever, you know? Give us more money, you know, et cetera, and so forth. So there is a way in which the word intelligence may mean its opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it certainly has been the case in the CIA and the NSA that the more money they have, the more spying they do, the less they really understand.
You know, and in your case, you have actually gone into a battle with people who wrote about Vietnam, wrote about Cambodia, you know, in terms of how many people were killed there, suggesting these massacres that you questioned in many ways about bloodbaths in Vietnam and the like. You also have questioned the whole chemical issue in Syria. Do you want to tell us about that, the use of chemical weapons there and what you've been writing as opposed to what the government has been saying?
Well, sure. I'll try to summarize it very briefly, and then maybe we can go back for a moment at least to the earlier political battles over bloodbaths. But with regard to the Syrian chemical weapons attack, I've done two things. First of all, in the immediate aftermath of the issuance of the White House intelligence paper, that I believe it was August 30th that they issued the paper, maybe it was the 31st, I wrote a story that made the point simply that this clearly was not a product of the intelligence community. Even though it was covered that way by the corporate media, it was clear, and in fact, a former intelligence official who understood what was going on told me point blank that it is clear that this is a cherry-picked report which the White House blessed and was pushing. And they obviously got somebody in the intelligence community, the head of the intelligence community, Director Clapper, to cooperate with them. But it was not something that Clapper or the rest of the intelligence community were willing to sign on to. And so it was clear that there were different views within the intelligence community about this alleged certainty that the Assad regime was responsible for the attack, and that in fact it was a serious attack with sarin, nerve gas, and so that was the first piece that I did. And then I actually spent 3 weeks in September trying to put together a coherent account of what might have happened. And at the end of that 3 weeks, I finally threw up my hands and I said, I can't do it. I couldn't manage to reach a coherent view of what happened. And so I waited for several more months. And it was not until, I guess, last month that I decided to resume analysis and writing about this issue. And what I've done now is to point out that there is a lot of evidence that was not apparent in the immediate aftermath, that is in September, October of last year, that raises some serious questions about the official line that is, again, the certainty that this was a government use of sarin. And at the center of this, reduce this to its most essential elements, at the center of it is the data that the UN the UN investigating team gathered from people who said that they were most seriously affected by the sarin attack. That is to say, these were supposedly, there were 36 people who they gathered data on, specifically from their doctors and through interviews with these people, and they were supposedly referred to them by the opposition as the people who were most serious affected. Well, the data that they collected, to make this story as short as possible, shows that they were not seriously affected, that in fact, some of them, of the 36, there were five or six who had no sign, no trace of sarin whatsoever in their blood, and the others had slight traces but did not exhibit any of the most fundamental signal of any serious exposure.
Sarin is supposed to be very deadly, right? I mean, I don't think you get exposed to sarin in a serious way and sort of live to talk to the UN about it, okay?
Well,
for the most part.
You can be exposed to an extent that you have some serious symptoms, but the most fundamental symptom is the contraction of the cornea of the eye. And that was not being exhibited, except for a very few of these 36 people. And so what that indicated was that the vast majority of the people who claimed that they were most seriously affected had not been really exposed in any serious way to sarin.
But on a point of... Rather than, you know, this is an important case and it's been, you've written about it, but what interests me about it is your own hesitancy, your own willingness to say, look, I really believe this to be true, but I can't prove it yet. So I am not going to write what I suspect. I want evidence. I want to be able to make a compelling case. And I think that shows the difference between your work as a journalist, which is, you know, known for integrity and known for accuracy, and some others who are really making points, either for reasons of partisanship or for, you know, reasons of you know, kind of being a know-it-all.
Well, you know, I do indeed try to be as absolutely accurate as possible and not to fall for the propaganda of anybody or to go off half-cocked, you know, on a theory that is not really supported by the evidence. And you know, I mean, this is something that I have, a pattern that I've tried to follow for a very long time. And this actually goes back to, you know, the Vietnam War and its aftermath and the issue of the bloodbath. I mean, you know, I guess the thing that I'm proudest of in my life is really that I was the one who spotted and exposed the Nixon administration's argument that unless the United States maintained troops and continued the war for another 4 years in Vietnam, there would be a horrible bloodbath with 500,000 people slaughtered by the communists in the aftermath of the U.S. withdrawal. And I had a lot of evidence to show that was simply a fabricated tale with no real historical evidence to support it. And indeed, that there was absolute mischief being carried out by the U.S. propagandists in displaying a former so-called Viet Cong defector who claimed that there would be a bloodbath. And I had actually collected earlier a set of interviews with him that were published in mimeograph by the U.S. Joint U.S. Public Affairs Office in Saigon, and in several interviews over a long period of time, he made no reference whatsoever to that. In fact, he said that what would happen was that there would be re-education camps. So I knew that this was a lie, and I said so, and I'm quite proud of that. Now, in the case of Cambodia, I mean, I recognized that I did make a mistake. I was initially convinced that the Cambodian regime that had taken over in the aftermath of the U.S. war, when the U.S. Stopped its bombing of Cambodia, which in itself was, of course, the cause of hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties, I believe that that government was in fact related to the old Indochinese Communist Party of that was dominated by the Vietnamese, and I felt, you know, I had reason to believe, I thought that its view was not dissimilar from that of the Vietnamese. What I found out later was that I had simply not had enough information about the Cambodian communist leadership under Pol Pot. In fact, that name Pol Pot didn't exist, was not known when I was writing the initial view of this situation in post-war Cambodia. But in any case, I simply did not have sufficient information on which to make an analysis of the issue of the post-war killings in Cambodia.
Well, by
1968, I realized that I'd made a mistake, and I said so publicly at that time. So,
in the Wikipedia description of you, you're quoted as saying, "I've been well aware for many years that I was guilty of intellectual arrogance. I was right about the bloodbath in Vietnam, so I assumed I would be right about Cambodia." Did you say that? What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that it was true that I was too overconfident. That the fact that I had found the truth about the bloodbath in Vietnam made me feel that I could analyze the situation in Cambodia, and I did so, as I say, without having sufficient information, and simply not knowing enough about the nature of this communist leadership in Cambodia. So, what I want to try to emphasize is that taught me a lesson, which I think that I have never forgotten ever since then, which is that it is necessary to check and recheck everything to make sure that you are on sound ground in drawing conclusions about these issues.
I wonder how many working journalists today would take what you just said seriously and to heart, as opposed to, as I think William Shawcross tried to do, try to discredit you and play gotcha with your numbers, but actually to recognize that there are problems that journalists sometimes have in confirming things, and sometimes we don't work hard enough to confirm things that we should try to do. The fact that you're saying this now gives me a lot more respect for what you've learned from this whole experience. I'd like you to stay with us, if you wouldn't mind, Garrick, because I want to get into your book about Iran.
Sure.
What you've been writing about Iran is so significantly different from what most others have been writing about it, and yet so important. So stay with us here on Media Channel Radio. We'll be back with Gareth Porter in a minute.
Come all you good workers and all you dispossessed. The perps are not in prison, nobody has confessed. Say, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Yeah, which side are you on, girl? Which side are you on? My daddy was a banker, but I'm not a banker's son. Cause I refuse to profit from the pain.
Danny Schechter here on Media Channel Radio with Gareth Porter. Gareth has written a new book called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, published this year. And he investigated the Iran nuclear scare. Tell us about your work in this field, because I think no issue has been more central in the Obama foreign policy than, Iran has been more central in Israeli foreign policy to treat Iran as this existential threat and try to either threaten bombing Iran or trying to get other countries to do so. What is the status of all of this?
Well, when I started to cover the issue of the Iranian nuclear program as far back as 2005, I was, I have to admit, rather naive about this, never having really followed the issue closely and just really getting started. I was inclined to think that there must be some smoke behind all the fire, and that therefore, it was somehow my assumption that Iran did want to get nuclear weapons, and that something funny had been going on. But as I continued to cover the issue, One thing after another simply opened my eyes repeatedly to a series of what I call anomalies, facts that simply didn't fit the overall line that was being reflected in the news media coverage and in official statements.
Hasn't there been a consistency in the Western news media that basically accepted the idea that Iran was lying, Iran was trying to build nuclear weapons, they were not allowing inspectors in, they were not giving a truthful accounting to international agencies, bad.
Absolutely. There has been complete consistency in the coverage of this issue going back really to the 1990s, but obviously accelerating tremendously under the Bush administration, and this is because particularly of a major event that occurred in 2002 when the MEK, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the Iranian terrorist group, aligned with the Israelis and, you know, more or less with the United States, with the Bush administration as well, basically outed the Natanz nuclear facility, which at that time was still not a matter of public information. The Iranians were constructing it without informing the IAEA. And so that was really the beginning of the very intensive development of what I call this false narrative surrounding the Iranian nuclear issue, which was that the Iranians were clearly carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program, and they were hiding this using a civilian nuclear program as the cover, as the front for that covert nuclear weapons effort. And so that notion, that narrative, has infused, I think, virtually every story that has been published in the corporate news media ever since then. And I, you know, devote quite a bit of space in the book to a number of occasions where the news media just blatantly misreported one or another of the episodes that are covered in my book. Instead of trying to understand what actually happened, they would simply take a handout effectively from the United States government, the Israelis, or one of the allies of the U.S. and Israel in this conflict. And so over and over again, you'd have these stories that bore no resemblance to what I have been able to show, what I've been documenting in my book, as what actually happened. For example, some of the key IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, reports in 2007, early 2008, which actually closed the file on a whole series of investigations that they'd made and admitted that they didn't have any information that they could put forward that conflicted with the explanations given by the Iranians. None of that was covered by the corporate news media at all. I mean, you know, they simply ignored what the reports actually said and instead reported the comments of high-ranking officials of the U.S. government or somebody anonymously commenting within the IAEA about this subject.
Is that because, and this is important for media critics like myself, you know, because on the one hand you think like there's a deliberate attempt here and strategy, which may not be inconsistent with, you know, a practice of omission. Not commission, of just leaving things out, which makes it very hard for people to get the context and get the background. And so in a cynical age, you know, it's easy to believe, well, they must be doing something or we wouldn't be paying all this attention to it.
Right. And you've raised the very interesting question of exactly what is the mechanism that is operating here when you have such blatant misreporting of this issue over a period of time so completely consistently. And you know, never having worked for, you know, a corporate news media publication, you know, I'm really not in a position to explain precisely how this works. I really don't know.
Maybe I can help you. Maybe I can help you because
yeah.
I did work for ABC and CNN and have some experience here. But it is, you know, a pattern that was like a pervasive line of coverage, and it was very hard to get any other views heard. You know, and it got to the point of almost being bizarre. I was, as I told you, I went to Iran, okay? And I came to realize that the fact that the president of Iran was booed at Columbia University was the best thing that ever happened to him, because he now galvanizes public support of people saying, you're insulting our president. He actually rallies people to him that didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
But they rallied to him because of this nuclear issue on one ground only, hypocrisy. How can the United States, which has 30,000 nuclear weapons, how can Israel, which has 600 or more nuclear weapons that they don't talk about, how can they criticize Iran that had no nuclear weapons?
Yes, and of course, this also, I mean, this issue of hypocrisy is directly related also to the question of Iran's international right to a peaceful nuclear program. And in my book, I devote an entire chapter to the beginnings of this issue, which is, you know, when the Islamic Republic of Iran was created in 1979. What happened after that in terms of both the decisions that were made by the Iranian government on its nuclear program, and then what the reaction of the Reagan administration was. And what I show in the book is that the Iranian government had decided finally, after a couple of years of being ready to pretty much dump the nuclear program of the Shah completely, they decided that they would have a much more downsized, more modest program. But they would continue to have the Bushehr reactor, and in order to do that, they needed to get nuclear fuel. So they were going to depend on a company, a multinational company that was based in France, to actually create the fuel assemblies that would be installed in the Bushehr reactor. And so then what happened was the Reagan administration tried to prevent them from being able to have any nuclear program at all. They didn't want them to have even Bushehr. They didn't want them to know how to, you know, anything that had to do with atomic power. And so they prevented the Germans from cooperating with the Bushehr, the rehabilitation of the Bushehr reactor. And they prevented the French from allowing the company, this multinational company based in France, from producing the fuel assemblies that they would need for Bushehr. And as a result of that, the Iranians had to have their own independent uranium enrichment capabilities. And
as the hip-hop community says, Gareth, you've dropped a little knowledge there in the middle of that conversation, noting that the Shah of Iran, who we supported, was the first people to have a nuclear program with the support of the United States. The United States likes to sell reactors abroad. That's Westinghouse's bread and butter, other manufacturers of nuclear reactors and the like.
Absolutely. They were totally behind it. The government was behind it, industry was behind it, the media were behind it, everybody was happy with it.
How important has been Israel's role in inflaming this issue, in your view?
Well, I'm glad you've asked that question, because it allows me then to get to the meat of what I think is the real headline story in my book. And that is that that the centerpiece of the case that has been made by the Bush administration, now carried over to the Obama administration, that Iran was and may still be carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program of some sort, is a set of documents that surfaced in 2004 that supposedly came from within this alleged Iranian nuclear weapons program, and that those documents were actually fabricated by the Israelis. And I have considerable detail about the whole story behind this document.
Wow, I've never heard that before.
Well, this is a really big story, and I have a lot of documentation. I mean, the Israeli fabrication, of course, I don't have somebody who's come out of Mossad saying, yeah, I know all about this, I was involved in it, or something like that. But the circumstantial evidence is very, very strong. I found a central inconsistency in the collection of documents that I was just referring to. Of course, the documents themselves are not available, you can't read them, but they're described in various places, particularly IAEA reports. And from that, you can discern that there's a serious problem here, because these documents portrayed a set of attempts to revise, to redesign the reentry vehicle of the Iranian Shahab-3 intermediate-range missile in order to apparently accommodate a nuclear weapon. Well, the problem is that what was shown was the reentry vehicle of an earlier version of the intermediate missile that the Iranians had actually given up on by the year 2000. Now, bear in mind that these drawings were supposedly made 2002, 2003. So 2 to 3 years after the Iranians had begun to work on a new missile that had a reentry vehicle that bore no resemblance to the one that is actually shown in those pictures. And I, you know, I've had Ali Heinonen, the former head of the IAEA's Department of Safeguards, actually confirm the fact that, yes, it was the pictures shown, the drawings shown, were of the earlier missile.
As you are talking, I'm thinking about Prime Minister Netanyahu's appearance at the UN with this cartoon that he showed of you know, kind of the nuclear danger in Iran that was looked like something from the Comedy Channel.
Right. It was from the old Roadrunner cartoons. Exactly.
You know,
yeah,
so,
and in fact, a number of people noted that and felt that Netanyahu had lowered the level of discussion so far that he really made a joke out of a serious matter.
Well, you know, I mean, this is how crude propaganda can be, and why,
yeah.
And this is my point, why the approach you've taken is so important, actually, to question everything, to look carefully at the documents, to question, you know, whether they're accurate or not, not to just accept them, you know, this is like an inside, but to actually look at, you know, the way in which these documents emerged, who is promoting them, and whether or not it's credible.
Yeah, and you know, this is, of course, what the news media is supposed to be doing all along. I mean, it's supposed to be fact-checking. It's supposed to be asking questions. It's supposed to be holding accountable. But in the case of Iran, I can tell you that it absolutely was not done at all. That's why I ended up writing this book. That's why I've basically been alone in doing this investigation of the whole scenario, the whole false narrative.
I have two little stories, one amusing, one maybe not so amusing, from being in Iran. You know, I confronted people there said, you've got to meet the president, you know, the former president of Iran. And I said to him, I said, are you trying to drop a nuclear bomb on my head? You know, and his reaction was exactly what yours is. He started laughing. He said, who told you that? No, we're not making any nuclear. You know, it was just, you know, it was sort of, I triggered a kind of a human response as opposed to a policy statement. And he seemed incredulous that I would, so-called friend being there, you know, asking him this question, people vouching for me as a serious journalist. And he, you know, he just started cracking up. He said,
well,
this
know,
is ridiculous. Okay.
Danny,
and then,
there's another story in my book that is, you know, you've just sort of brought to mind in that vignette. And that is that what people do not understand about the Iranians is that whatever the faults of this, you know, so-called theocratic system of Shia law, Sharia law, which is a Shia, in this case, a Shia law in Iran, whatever the problems associated with it, and they are certainly they exist. There's one fact that people should be aware of, and that is that it is because of the fact that the supreme leader in the Iranian system has the power to say through a fatwa that something can be done or cannot be done. That is why the Iranian regime has a very peculiar, I would say, really unique relationship to the issue of weapons of mass destruction. And what I did in the book was to go back to the Iran-Iraq war and to document what actually happened during that war when Iran was subjected to a barrage, a constant set of attacks with chemical weapons by the Iraqi military from 1981 through 1988. And the Iranian military wanted to have the Iranians retaliate with chemical weapons, to come up with their own chemical weapons to retaliate and to get the Iraqis to stop doing that. And Ayatollah Khomeini, the supreme leader at the time during the 1980s, said no, this is not allowed under Islam. Iran cannot...
Right, and Iran has actually called for denuclearization in the region and in the world, has been a voice for nuclear disarmament, actually, although unreported in our country. And you know, one of the things about, you know, there's the other joke, which is how do we know that Iran had these weapons, or rather that Saddam had these weapons? The answer was because we have the receipts, you know, having provided them to
right.
him.
So, right.
you know, there's so many nuances here, but, you know, you have been dogged in pursuing, you know, the actual facts on the ground here. You know, the other issue that I was trying to tell you about was we were talking about this nuclear issue. I was giving a little talk there about my work, and it, you know, somebody questioned me, how do I feel about them having this nuclear program? And, you know, I said, look, you have a right. Other countries have nuclear programs. You have a right to have it. I would just say, you know, you ask yourself this question. Is it smart, given the lack of safety of nuclear power plants and the like? And you know, we've had experiences in our own company. This was just before the Fukushima thing happened, okay? And the people there were like, wow, nobody's ever raised this before, you know, that there's an environmental factor in all of this, you know? And I'm saying, hey, you guys have a lot of sun here. Have you ever heard of solar power? You know, so, it is nuanced. It is important. But to label Iran this way, in a consistent pattern, going back 30 years, says something, doesn't it, about our media and our the way in which it seems to march in lockstep with the government?
Well, certainly it does. It provides, in my view, the most spectacular, longest-running case of precisely what you've just referred to as a news media contingent walking, running, crawling in lockstep, if you will, with the official line. It is really quite remarkable, particularly that this continued and even accelerated in the aftermath of the disaster that the news media coverage had clearly been and was admitted to have been with regard to the run-up to the war in Iraq.
Let's just give listeners a quick recap. The name of the book, how they can get it. Do you have a website? How do they reach you? Because I really want people who are listening to this to recognize that, you know, your contribution to journalism and the fact that when you read stories by Gareth Porter distributed by IPS or on the internet, you're going to learn something that you didn't know before. That I think can't be said of everybody.
That I can guarantee, people. I definitely can guarantee that. So the book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. It's published by Just World Books, three words, Just World Books. And their website, justworldbooks.com, I'm sorry, maybe it's .net. Excuse me. I'm not sure.
This is
I'm
your
really
opportunity to plug. Let's get this right.
Yeah, I got to get my plugs right.
Okay, but you look it up under the name of the book.
Yeah, Just World Books website is the best place to go. And, of course, it's also on the usual sites.
All right, so books. I would recommend that and the journalism, you know, of Gareth Porter. And thank you so much for joining us on the media channel. Danny Schechter is signing off here with you this time, but let's stay in touch and let's try to keep focusing on these issues because who knows if, you know, some sort of invented story will lead to war as it almost did in Syria and could again, certainly did in Vietnam and could again with Iran. Thank you again for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks, Danny.
And we just want to sign off now with my colleague Kim Harrisburg from Johannesburg, who's sitting in the studio with us. She's been in New York for a few weeks now. She joined us when she first arrived, and she's been exposed to the American media. A quick take from you, the American media. How are you feeling about it?
Hi, Danny. Thanks for having me. Well, for me, it's been really interesting about how, you know, a paradigm shift can take place. You hop on a flight and suddenly you're in the Big Apple, and all the stories you read about back home in South Africa, which seem so far and distant, are suddenly right on your doorstep. And that happens just from a flight, which has been really interesting for me. You know, people overseas kind of feel like United States is the center of the world, and you kind of get here and you realize that maybe this role model of yours isn't, you know, it has flaws and foibles and blemishes and things like that, and it kind of sets back your expectations in a good and a bad way. So it's been really interesting for me my past 2 weeks in New York, far away from South Africa, but kind of reassessing kind of the influence of media, the way I saw it from back home, and how I see it now actually being in the United States.
Well, you come a long way, baby, but it doesn't mean that the media is much better necessarily, or is not in need of vast improvement. And that's certainly what MediaChannel.org is trying to do, what we've been trying to do here on PRN-FM on this weekly program, Thursdays at 5. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. You can certainly feedback to me at dissector@MediaChannel.org. We're going to have the actual podcast of Gareth Porter's comments will be up on MediaChannel.org in a day or two, so please check it out. Also in the archives at PRN-FM. So thank you again for being here. We try every week to find people in the media who you may have heard of, you may not have heard of, to offer perspectives and some information, not only about what they reported, but how they reported it and what the challenges are of trying to cover the world in a way that has some makes a difference, that has some impact. And so that's why I'm doing this program. I hope you find it of value, and I hope that you'll come back again next week and check out MediaChannel.org, my blog, NewsDissector.net. Every night I try to talk about what's in and not in the news. So thank you again for being with us. Thank you, Martin, for actually being the man on the board.
We